I hate my life.
What happened to the stage?
So today I'm going to be a little bit more technical. I want to discuss for your edification the evolution of the mitzvah of blowing the shofar. How it really started very small, and through a variety of rabbinic enactments and biblical interpretations, it became bigger and bigger and bigger to the way that we do it today. First, all of us know that there is a mitzvah to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. So first of all, even then you have a certain ambiguity. Is the mitzvah to blow the shofar, a ram's horn, or is the mitzvah to hear the shofar? Now, you might think, well, if the mitzvah is to blow the shofar, how am I doing the mitzvah if I'm not blowing it? Well, that's not a kasha, because the one that blows would be our shaliach for it. Or no, he's not my shaliach. I'm directly doing the mitzvah because I'm hearing it. So let me point out that we have a certain ambiguity. We call the mitzvah tikiyas shofar, which means blowing the shofar. But if you happen to look at the bracha that we recite asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav, that God commanded me by His commandments, v'tzivanu lishmoa, to hear. Right, so it's an interesting question whether the mitzvah is the blowing or the hearing, but there is a mitzvah that we go through this process. Halachically, a shofar does not have to be a ram's horn. It does have to be the horn of an animal, but you can use antelope, In fact, you've ever seen, I'm sure you've seen these gigantic chauffeurs. Have you seen like 20 foot, they're not 20 foot, but you know, maybe 6 foot long chauffeurs? These are from big antelopes. You can use antelopes, mountain goats, and the like. The only requirement is that it be a horn from an animal. You can't use a trombone or a trumpet for a shofar. And according to some opinions, it must be a kosher animal. Other opinions say it doesn't even have to be a kosher animal. In theory, a moose horn might be acceptable. But there is only one animal who, although it's kosher, we exclude the horn from being a kosher shofar. And that is, we don't use the horn of a cow or a bull. Cow is female, right? You cannot use a bull's horn for a shofar. And why is that? So there are a few different reasons, but one reason is very interesting. That the cow or the calf or the bull, whatever it is the same species as the sin of the golden calf. And on the day of Rosh Hashanah, when we are pleading for our lives, we don't want to bring to our prayers that which will remind God of our sin. Now, of course, let me explain that. Obviously, God does not have to be reminded of anything. But there's a certain arrogance in bringing your sin to God. God knows. So we don't blow with anything that's reminiscent of the golden calf. And that's why we don't use the horn of a bull, cow, calf, or the like. Now the phrase that the Gemara uses is a phrase that maybe you should memorize it, because it even appears in modern Hebrew, although it's from the Gemara. That is, Ein kategor nasa sanegor. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. But Ein kategor nasa sanegor means a prosecuting attorney cannot be a defense attorney. Meaning, if somebody's into the prosecution, they're not going to be able to be your defense. So the same thing. The Chet HaEgel is like a prosecution against us in Shemayim. So when we're pleading for mercy with the shofar, we don't use the horn of a cow that way. But a mountain goat, all these other animals are good. However, in spite of the fact that all of them are good, antelopes, gazelles, and the like, but there is normally a preference to use a ram's horn. A ram is a male sheep. And that's not because the Torah says that. The Torah does not require that. But because the ram is reminiscent of another great thing that we did. If the cow's horn is no good because it's a reminder of the golden calf, the ram's horn is a commemoration of Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his only son, Yitzchak. And if you remember at the last moment, when God said, don't do it, there was a ram that was trapped in the bushes, and the ram was brought instead of Yitzchak. So the ram connects us to the story of Yitzchak. And of course, according to our tradition, Akedas Yitzchak actually happened on Rosh Hashanah. That's a tradition. In fact, you will notice that the Torah reading of the second day of Rosh Hashanah is the story of Akedas Yitzchak and the like. Okay. Now, where does the Torah say you have to blow a shofar on Rosh Hashanah? So there are two places where the Torah says it. The first is in Chumash Vayikra, Parshas Emor. And this is chapter 23, verse 24. Right? 23, 24. And it says, Daber o b'nei Yisrael leimor, speak to the children of Israel, b'chodesh ha-shvi'i b'yachod l'chodesh, in the seventh month, on the first day of the month. Seventh month? I thought Rosh Hashanah is the first month of the year. So you understand, I hope, that in the chronological dating of the Torah works with a different calendar, actually. The Torah considers the month of Nisan to be the first month of the year, because that is when we left Egypt. As a result, the Torah B'chlal does not give names for months. You're not going to find Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, Teves. Those are Babylonian names that we didn't get till the Babylonian exile. They are actually foreign names. How does the Torah describe months? It only uses numbers. First month, second month, third month. You will not find any month given a name in the Torah. So that's one thing. The second thing to keep in mind, though, is that when the Torah says first month, second month, third month, fourth month, it is not counting from Tishrei, first month, second month, third month. It is counting from Nisan. So that gives us a bit of a paradox. The month of Tishrei, which is the beginning of the Jewish year, is actually the seventh month. Why? Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, that's the month we're in now, Tishrei. So this is pretty strange. We must be the only society in the world that starts its year in the seventh month. That's almost a contradiction, in a sense. You know, normally you'd figure when you start a year, that's the first month. January is the first month, right? You don't say, start your year in July. And if you started your year in July, you would call July the first month. We live with the paradox, right? So already, Jews are used to living with paradoxes and contradictions. We start our year in the seventh month. Kind of strange, but that's what it says. So therefore, the Torah does not say, look how the Torah is worded here. The Torah does not say, on Rosh Hashanah, blow the shofar. The Torah says, blow the shofar on the first day of the seventh month. That's the identifier. Okay, now, how does it describe blowing the shofar? Zichron Teruah. A remembrance or a commemoration of Teruah. Now, Teruah is a shouting or blowing sound. But do you see how ambiguous it is? It doesn't tell me what type of sound. And it doesn't even tell me it's an animal horn. It doesn't say the word shofar. It says a remembrance of Teruah. Now Teruah can mean shouting. It can mean singing. It can mean blowing a sound out of a horn. But Teruah does not directly say shofar. So how do you know that the medium of the Teruah is shofar? Maybe the medium of the Teruah is my own mouth. Maybe it's saying, I shout out to God, I cry out to God, I pray to God, which of course we do anyway. Where do you get the idea that the Teruah, the sounding out, the noise making, is connected to shofar? Answer, this is where the oral law comes in. Again, today I'm going to be a bit more technical, although we will eventually get to the spiritual meanings of shofar as well. There is a methodology of biblical interpretation called Gezeira Shava. Have you heard of Gezeira Shava? Gezeira Shava is a methodology that God gave to Moshe, where the sages are empowered to examine two biblical texts, and if they use identical wording, that's like an encoded message that you can compare one with the other, because they use an identical wording. Now, it says by Rosh Hashanah, a remembrance of Teruah, but it doesn't say shofar. Teruah is shouting or making a noise, but it doesn't say shofar. But in Parshas Bahar, which is the end of Vayikra, it talks about Shemitah. That's the year we're in today. Right? This is chapter 25 in Vayikra. Right? The Shemitah year, every seventh year in the land of Israel, is like a Shabbos for the land. The land must rest. One does not farm the land. One acknowledges the land belongs to God. And we still keep that today, this year. This year, it's almost finished for another 2 weeks. This is the Shemitah year. But there's something else in the Torah that we don't do today. That is, after seven Shemitahs, right? Seven cycles of seven, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, Shemitah year. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, Shemitah year. 7 times 7. After 49 years, there is what you might call the grand Shemitah year. And that is called Yovel, which in English is Jubilee. And what happens in the Jubilee year? Well, at a minimum, everything in Shemitah gets picked up. We don't farm the land. But a lot more things happen. In the Jubilee year, slaves go free. In fact, the phrase that's on the Liberty Bell, anybody here from Philadelphia, proclaim liberty throughout the land, that is taken from Leviticus. That is taken from Yovel. Everybody's free. Not only that, but all property goes back to its original owners. That's pretty amazing. You know, it is said, it might be a legend, that the pilgrims bought Manhattan Island from the Indians, American Indians, for the equivalent of $24 worth of beads. Well, had this been in Israel and had this been Yovel, after 50 years, Manhattan Island goes back to the Indians. Now, the question would be, we don't keep Yovel today, because Yovel only applies when all of the Jews are living in the land of Israel. Until Mashiach comes, we're not there. But in theory, it would be very, very difficult. That would mean, let's say you have developed land with hotels and all sorts of things. Whoever could trace himself going back thousands of years to be the legal halachic heir of that property can come in and say, hey, I want the Tel Aviv beach strip. Now, of course, he doesn't get the hotel for free. In other words, he gets the hotel, but he has to pay the value of the hotel. He gets the land for free. But if he wants the hotel, he has to pay for the hotel. So you would actually need rabbinic lawyers to iron this out, because it's quite complicated. You get the land back, but you have to pay for the improvements to the land, right? Because when the land was sold, it was just land. Now, this is Yovel. So Yovel is very unique. It is the 50th year after 7 Shemitah cycles. Slaves go free. Liberty. Land goes back. That prevents over-concentration. So if you're a socialist or a communist, you actually like this halacha. It prevents over-concentration of ownership because it brings all the land back to its original sources. But in addition, the Torah says the following. On, not the Rosh Hashanah of Yovel, on the Yom Kippur of Yovel, and this mitzvah is not done today, the Torah says, Ta'aviru shofar, you shall blow a shofar, teruah, a shofar of blowing. Now, unlike Rosh Hashanah, where the word shofar is not used, in the case of Yovel, which is a totally different mitzvah, it's every 50 years and it's on Yom Kippur, nothing to do with that, but it uses shofar teruah. So, based on the principle of gezerah shava, again, what is gezerah shava? If the Torah uses the same words in two places, the rabbis are authorized to draw a connection between the two. So we make the following drash. Just as the word truah in connection to the Jubilee year has a shofar, so too the word truah, when used in Rosh Hashanah, although the word shofar is not there, we connect it to the Jubilee, and that's why it's a shofar. I guess what is surprising about this a little bit is, you know, the shofar is so important, it is so essential to Rosh Hashanah, and paradoxically, the word shofar does not appear in the mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah. It appears in the mitzvah of Yovel, and the only way we import it into Rosh Hashanah is via the methodology. I'll give you one second. Is via the methodology of Gezeirah Shavah. I hope I'm not being too technical, but again, as I say, I will get into the more spiritual meanings, but I also want you to understand a bit of the technical background. So now, what we've gained via the Gezeirah Shavah is we now know that the sound that's called teruah is not a singing sound, it's not a vocal sound, but it's via a shofar. And apparently we know what a shofar is. Apparently the Gemara doesn't have to prove. We know a shofar is an animal horn, and that's kind of... No, yeah.
So when was the last Shemitah Jubilee?
Okay, so that's very interesting. The last Jubilee was over 100 years before the destruction of the first temple. There was no Jubilee, even when we had the second temple. There was no Jubilee because most of the Jews were not living in the land of Israel. So the last Jubilee would be, well, I mean, the first temple was destroyed, according to historians, in 586 BCE. And this is 100 years earlier than that. So the last Jubilee was around 626 before the Common Era. That's quite a long time ago. We absolutely do not do the Jubilee today. Now, some people are discussing this. Some people are discussing a very interesting issue. We are approaching, Baruch Hashem, even before Mashiach, a 51%, meaning right now, the number of Jews who live, the percentage of Jews who live in Israel is like 49.5%. Almost a majority. Some people are discussing the halachic possibility that at whatever point in time you get over 50% of the Jews in the land of Israel, would that bring back the Jubilee? Now that would be enormously complicated. Now I think with slaves it wouldn't be a big problem. You know, we don't have slaves, but with, in terms of tracing back property, that would be real, real, real complicated. But I think, number one, there are two answers why I think Yovel will not be reinstituted, even when you get most Jews until the Mashiach comes. Number one, first of all, we keep on discovering hidden Jewish populations. Meaning to say there are people in Afghanistan, people in all sorts of countries who may have Jewish lineage. So even if you think, you know, the 50% of who I think are Jewish are here, you know, there'll be millions of people who are Jewish who aren't here. But number two, it's more, in order for a Jubilee to be triggered, it's more than people. It also requires the division of the land of Israel to the tribes. Meaning Reuven has his section, Shimon has his section, and that we're not going to have until Mashiach. Meaning you also require a tribal division of the land. So as a result, where we're left with is, we do keep the sabbatical year, which is the Shemitah, but we do not keep the Yovel year, and we didn't even during the temple periods. And we're not going to keep it until the coming of the Mashiach. Did you want to have a question?
Yeah, is there another place in the Torah where the word Terumah is used? And how do, if so, how do you know which one?
Teruah. There are a few places, not that many. And how do you know is a very excellent question. Meaning, so you're actually right. The Gemara tells us, because of what you said, because, you know, any guy can compare any words. Vayedaber, Hashem, Hashem, God's name appears in virtually every paragraph of the Torah. That doesn't allow you to make comparisons. So there actually is a tradition that the appropriate pairs that you can use were part of the oral law that God gave Moses in Sinai. It's almost like a dictionary list, meaning the following word pairings are legitimate for rabbinic interpretation. And therefore one cannot make up. For example, I would not be allowed to look at words and simply make in my own gezeira shava. So unlike certain rules like kal v'chomer, which are logical rules, meaning the rabbis could just use their logic, this does require adherence to a list, an authorized list of comparisons. So you are.
Where is that list?
Oh well. We actually, in other words, well, we kind of work backwards, meaning to say this was said to be an oral tradition that was handed down, and it is recorded in the Talmud, but not in one place. Meaning to say, whenever the Talmud uses Gezeirah Shavah, our assumption is they're working off that list. But we don't have the list. I can't show you the list, but they're working off it. So every Gezeirah Shavah they use is based on that list.
So just to clarify, like, how the math works. So
yep.
The 49th year is regular Shemitah year.
Yep.
And the 50th year is Yovel.
Yep.
But then, in like the next 50 years, the 98th.
Okay, great question. That is an argument, and it's very, very relevant. How do you compute the next Yovel and the next Shemitah even? Meaning the following. Is Yovel year zero? And therefore, the first year of the Shemitah cycle, year one, is the year after Yovel. And then you do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, Shemitah. Or is Yovel year one towards the next Shemitah? It's a machlokas in the Gemara. And that's going to be very, very important, because when will your Shemitahs be? Right? Is your Shemitah 6 years after Yovel? Or is your Shemitah 7 years after Yovel?
Because if it's seven years after Yovel, that means it was 8 years between Shemitah years.
That's correct. That is correct. Absolutely correct. So that is a machlokas in the Gemara, and it's a very practical machlokas. Relevant, yeah.
How do we apply it now?
Today it's not relevant, because since today Yovel is not observed, so we just go continuously 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, and Yovel, even the hypothetical Yovel, is not a year zero. But when there was a Yovel, it may very well be that the Shemitah would be moved. In other words, the point I'm making is, the year that we keep Shemitah today would not necessarily have been the year of Shemitah when there was the Jubilee year. It would have been later. It would have been moved later. But today, we just have continuous sevens, because Yovel is no longer a placeholder.
Because if Yovel was every 50 and Shemitah is every 7, then only once every 7 years would they be next to each other.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. Meaning, it's not always the case. We think year 49 and year 50 are always going to be next to each other. That is absolutely not the case, unless Yovel is a placeholder. If Yovel is year 0, then you will always have a 49 and a 50 together. If Yovel is one of the years, then Shemitah can float vis-a-vis Yovel. Very, very excellent. Yeah, again, I don't want to confuse people. If you've got that, that's good. If not, the only bit of knowledge I do want you to realize is that we do not keep the Yovel today, because we only keep the Yovel when, number one, most of the Jews are living in Israel, and number two, the land is divided based on tribes, which we do not have today. Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, why do we keep the Shemitah and not the Yovel?
Ah,
why
excellent.
Keep
Shemitah? Yeah, excellent question. According to, okay, so I'll give you a technical answer. The technical answer is that the words that you need most of the Jews living in Israel, they only appear in the Jubilee verses. They don't appear in the Shemitah verses. And as a result, the exemption of Yovel would not carry over to Shemitah. That's one answer. Another answer is that indeed, many opinions say Shemitah today is only rabbinic, meaning the Torah, in other words, on a Torah level, Shemitah vanishes together with Yovel. But the rabbis wanted us to remember the idea of Shemitah, so they put it in. Yovel, they didn't want, that would be too much of a hardship. In fact, I don't want to get too far afield, but you know, one of the major, major controversies in Shemitah law that applies even today is that the Israeli chief rabbinate, following a precedent set by the first chief rabbi of Palestine, this is before there was a state, this was a very, very great, great Gadol and Tzaddik, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, Rav Cook, a bit controversial, but a great, great man. So he instituted a rule where all of the land is sold to non-Jews, like symbolically, before Shemitah, and that allows the Jewish farmers to cultivate the land. The same principle of chametz. He did this because at the time in the 1920s there was mass starvation, and without people farming the land, people would have died. So he created the mechanism that he felt that Shemitah could be inoperative if the land belongs to non-Jews. Now, to this day, the Israeli chief rabbinate does this. But most members of the yeshiva community do not accept that. They say, even if Rav Cook allowed it, he only allowed it under extenuating circumstances of mass starvation, and that doesn't apply today. This is called, maybe you hear this phrase bandied about, heter mechira. Heter mechira means the dispensation of selling the land to goyim. So you'll hear people say, they don't even know what it is, but they say, from people say, I don't rely on heter mechira. Sometimes you'll ask him, what is heter mechira? I don't know, I just know I don't rely on it. Okay, so at least you know what it is. And it is true that most of the yeshiva world does not rely. But why am I mentioning this? I do want to mention that one of Rev Cook's arguments why we could rely on the heter mechira is, since the Shemitah year today is only a rabbinic ordinance and not a Torah ordinance, there are certain leniencies in rabbinic shmita that you're not going to have on Torah. Again, that's just an idea. That your question is a very good question. That many opinions say shmita is the same as yovel, but the rabbis just enacted shmita and the like. Okay, so I'm going to stop a little early because I know you have a class right away. But let me just say, so what we've established therefore is through the principle of gezeira shava. We know that the trua sound, now I haven't said what sound that is yet, but the trua is a shouting sound, is not a vocal sound, it is a sound via the blowing of a shofar. Okay, but now the question becomes, how many of these sounds do I have to make? It only says trua, that could be one shout, but how do I know how many? So here we have to know two things. The Torah actually uses the word trua two times by Rosh Hashanah. One time is the verse that I read to you. That was in Parshas Emor. Let's find it again. That's where? That's chapter 23. Verse 24, but the Torah repeats it in the book of Bamidbar, Parshas Pinchas, and this is chapter 28 in Bamidbar, the book of Numbers. I'm sorry, chapter 29, Pasuk Aleph, Yom Trua Yielochem, a day of blowing. Again, it doesn't say shofar, but we know that's from the Gezeira Shava. So, the word Trua appears twice by Rosh Hashanah. One in Vayikra, and one in Bamidbar. The word trua appears an additional time in Yovel, which is you blow the shofar trua. So here I use the Gezeira Shava again for double duty. In other words, the Gezeira Shava is used not only to make it shofar, but also how many truot you need. Rosh Hashanah is two, Yovel is one, but since I compare the two, I bring the two of Rosh Hashanah into the one of Yovel, so on Yovel you got to do three. And vice versa, I bring the one of Yovel into Rosh Hashanah, so Rosh Hashanah you got to do three. So where this leaves us is, okay, you have to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah three times. We certainly blow a lot more than three times. Okay, so we'll leave that for the next year. But that's where I want you to, in other words, we're using the Gezeira Shava for two distinct ideas. The Gezeira Shava establishes shofar as opposed to a vocalization. And number two, the Gezeira Shava brings you up to three blowings. How do I get three? Because Rosh Hashanah has two blowings, Trua in Leviticus, and Trua in Numbers. Yovel has one blowing, Trua, Shofar Trua. The Gezeira Shava says, I merge and I combine the two paragraphs, so therefore on Yovel I do three, because I take the two of Rosh Hashanah, merge them into Yovel, and on Rosh Hashanah I do three, because I take the one of Yovel, and I merge it into the two of Rosh Hashanah. Net result, both on the Yom Kippur of Yovel, which we don't do today, and on every Rosh Hashanah, which we do today, you must blow the shofar three times. Okay? Next year, we'll try to develop how do we go from 3 to 100. We actually blow the shofar at least 100 times, and often because of corrections and the like, we might blow it 500 times. But the Torah says three times, and we'll see how you get there. Yeah?
So there's a lot of things that are repeated, like, in
Deuteronomy, we don't do twice, like, census.
Yeah.
It's the Mitzvah census, or the
Yeah.
A lot of other
things. No, that is a good point. And again, repetitions have significance, meaning to say, they're not always used for doubling, but they have to be used for something, meaning that the Torah does not repeat things without reasons. But it's up to the Chachamim to determine what they think is the most logical, plausible significance of the repetition. And here they determined that it was numbers, how many times you do it. Now there will be spiritual, again, today I'm being relatively mechanical because you need to know mechanics as well, but we will see that these are not just arbitrary, made up things. There are going to be deep spiritual and even mystical reasons for this structure. But I do want you to understand the bricks and mortar of the structure as well. Yeah?
So you said that you figure out how many times to blow the shofar in Rosh Hashanah based on the word
Teruah. How many times Teruah?
Why wouldn't you go the other way around and say, if on the Jubilee year it says the word Teruah once, why can't you infer that you take the one time from Rosh Hashanah and bring it in for that?
Well, because the reason would be that since it says two by Rosh Hashanah, then you can't use Gezeirah Shavah to contradict what the text actually says. The text says for Rosh Hashanah at least two. Right, so you can't use the Gezeirah Shavah to make it like Yovel and knock it down to one. So the most you can do is augment. You can add, but you can't use merger to diminish because you would then be contradicting the explicit directive of the text itself. Okay? Okay, we'll see you. Take care, have a good day.
Nice to meet you.
Just
started
it
today.
Oh, well, welcome.
I came yesterday. I'm here for the...
Good to have you.
Pleased to meet you. Yeah, Remez and Elul, twice in the Tanakh and once in the...
Yes.